seeking consensus. Success under these conditions depended on securing acceptance and support for royal policies. Royal assemblies provided the main mechanism to achieve this. These had echoes of the much earlier Germanic tribal gatherings, Ting, of free warriors. But by 755 among the Franks, they were fairly exclusive affairs, meeting under a variety of labels: Placitum, Synodus, Conventus, and Marchfeld. The latter literally means March Field, deriving from the practice of meeting between March and May as the grass grew long enough to make campaigning possible. Religious beliefs greatly influenced the timing of important meetings, with top-level encounters between the different Carolingian kings after 843 usually being held on prominent holy days, like All Saints. The combination of consultative assembly and military muster reinforced the personal element, since the king's presence was essential. It also reversed the relationship of the royal progress. Rather than touring his kingdom, the king now made the kingdom come to him, with some lords traveling hundreds of miles to meet him and participate in the assembly. Elite sociability was fostered through common activities like hunting, feasting, and praying, which accompanied assemblies and provided additional opportunities for discussions, especially those that needed to be more private. Perhaps most importantly, they provided space for the king to present himself and display the virtues associated with good kingship, including leadership, justice, generosity, and piety. Discussion of consensus requires some preliminary qualifications to avoid romanticizing it as some kind of manly, noble warrior culture, with the king aided by reasonable, pragmatic, and patriotic men. The sources are particularly difficult to interpret. There were no written rules, obliging us to infer these from how chroniclers recorded actual behavior. Such writers were generally partisan, celebrating or criticizing kings, invoking idealized kingdoms, or airing grievances like Hincmar, the 9th century Archbishop of Reims, who wrote his De Ordine Palatii after his exclusion from the inner circle. His admonition to King Carloman to follow the advice of wise old men like himself was clearly personally motivated. But Hincmar's work, like similar pieces, is still instructive because his arguments reflected broadly accepted norms. Hincmar urged the king to hold a general assembly of important men to test their response to his plans and to assist in determining general objectives. A meeting of seniors and principal advisers should follow to agree the specifics. This more select gathering would have something of the character of a friendship group, in which members would be freer to express opinions, as there would be less risk of humiliation if the king rejected their advice. The contemporary concept of friendship, amicitia, allowed the king to widen his inner circle beyond his immediate relations, some of whom might be proving troublesome. Friendship could also shorten the formal hierarchy of vassalage, allowing the king to employ junior but able or materially useful men as his familiares. Hierarchy remained fluid, as the aforementioned description of Carolingian structures has illustrated, with dukes outranking counts, yet both still considered free men, directly subject to the king. The king's friends were already his vassals, but were bound by additional, ritualized activities staged deliberately to indicate a particular proximity. For instance, the king and his friends might alternate playing the roles of host and guest over different courses at a shared banquet. Gift-giving and exaggerated public displays of joy and sorrow were additional methods. Friends could extend royal influence by acting as brokers between the king and their own relations and clients. This was a major reason for seeking the king's friendship, since the broker gained prestige amongst his own clientele through his enhanced ability to secure favors and rewards. Those involved had a vested interest in keeping things in proportion. Excessive requests from either the king or his friends risked rejection and humiliating failure. Much of imperial governance thus relied on discreet negotiation, often via friends and other third parties, to find acceptable arrangements that were then presented publicly as if they were spontaneous decisions. This form of rule was facilitated by the relatively small size of the Carolingian and Ottonian elites. Widukind of Corvey, writing around 970, names 130 people in his chronicle, while even 40 years later, Tietmar of Merseburg still only mentions 500, one-fifth of whom were women. The overall number of families was, of course, even smaller. Moreover, the senior lords employed exactly the same methods to manage their own jurisdictions and wider networks. Social norms and ideals of justice and good kingship were also common currency. Finally, Frankish nobles also practiced partible inheritance for their own allodial possessions, so that, other than scale, there was no fundamental difference between the Carolingians, who partitioned their empire into different kingdoms, and their nobles, who divided their lands amongst their sons. This sustained the hierarchy of power. What mattered to the lords was their personal proximity to the king, not their accumulation of hereditary possessions. None of this meant that things necessarily ran smoothly. Admission to the Primores Regni was decided competitively, not consensually. This pinpoints the paradox of early medieval imperial politics. Governance was intended to achieve its goals amicably, but the actual process of seeking agreement was often disruptive and even violent. Consensus both shaped and reflected the shifting power balance, especially that between the king and his leading vassals. Disputes were personal, not constitutional, and generally stemmed from mismanaged expectations. Carolingian governance, 800-919. Having established the basic components to the governance of the early empire, we can now turn to follow how it developed during the 9th century. The rapidity of Carolingian conquests from the 770s stoked expectations of rewards that could no longer be met after the 820s, as imperial expansion halted amidst Arab, Viking, and Slav incursions. The fratricidal wars after 829 were about dividing the spoils within what was still considered a common Frankish realm. Fighting was relatively brief and punctuated by frequent negotiations, often brokered discreetly by senior clergy. It was accepted that the internal strife differed from the earlier external wars of conquest, in that the defeated side were still Christian Franks, who could not be expropriated or enslaved. The particularly bloody Battle of Fontenoy in June 841 shocked the elite and encouraged the collective lordly pressure that obliged the Carolingian royals to accept the first major partition of the empire at the Treaty of Verdun, 843. The partition into Lotharingia, East Francia, and West Francia demonstrated the personal rather than institutional character to Carolingian rule, in that it did not follow geographical, ethnic, linguistic, or ecclesiastical boundaries. Instead, as eldest brother, Lothar went first, choosing to base his imperial authority in the Middle Kingdom anchored on Aachen and Rome, while Louis II received the lands to the east, and Charles II those to the west. There may be something of a bargain basement feel to the later Carolingians, but they were neither as inept nor as indolent as both contemporary critics and later writers maintained. Charles III only acquired his sobriquet, the Fat, in the 12th century. The real problem was not irresistible centrifugal forces of dukes and kinglets seeking independence, but their own inability to produce legitimate heirs. This fueled competition for possession of the different kingdoms created by their partitions. Charles III's deposition and death without legitimate heirs in 888 ended the last reunification and triggered a particularly vicious round of murderous quarrels amongst the Carolingian aristocracy. Rivalry within the royal house stirred activism amongst the senior lords. Carolingian kings were obliged to consult their own vassals more often and to tolerate greater autonomy in return for military support. Meanwhile, many lords were left to shift for themselves in difficult circumstances, including threats from external raiders. Bishoprics and counties were now held successively by members of the same family, creating further vested interests and factions. The Babenberg family, deriving their name from Bamberg, were promoted in Franconia by Charles III, but they lost out through the accession of Arnulf as king in East Francia in 887, since he promoted the rival Conradina to counter their regional influence. The resulting Babenberger feud from 902 to 906 saw their defeat and the stabilization of the Eastern monarchy under Conradina influence. Lotharingia broke up completely after 888, though, as we have heard, the imperial title remained associated with the Italian kingdom until 924. Italian bishops like those in Modena and Reggio regained some of the autonomy they had lost under the Lombards and acquired additional properties entrusted to their own sub-vassals in return for serving the Carolingians and their local successors based in Friol, Spoleto, and Ivrea. The bishops overshadowed the counts after the 880s, thanks to their control of Italy's still numerous towns, whereas comital jurisdiction was confined largely to the countryside. By the early 10th century, bishops began extending their jurisdiction over the suburban zones and acquired additional royal properties in return for backing the fairly weak Italian kings. West Francia had a larger and longer established lordly hierarchy, enjoying more stable local power. Around seven duchies emerged as the monarchy struggled to repel the Vikings, who established themselves permanently in what would become Normandy. The Capetian family assumed a position equivalent to that held by the Carolingians' forebears at the Merovingian court by establishing a controlling influence in Paris after 885. This enabled the Capetians to eventually displace the Carolingians entirely and to become kings of France after 987. Despite the Babenberger feud, East Frankish lords remained appreciative of the positive role their king could play in coordinating defense of the long northern and eastern frontiers. Crucially, an inner group in East Francia had become accustomed to proximity to royal power and had no desire to share the associated benefits more widely. While they continued to bicker amongst themselves, they still wanted the monarchy to succeed and took steps to avert a series of potential crises. Frankish custom maintained that boys could not be kings and that their lands should revert to the senior adult male of the dynasty. This situation occurred in 900 at the accession of Louis (IV), close parenthesis, the child. But the East Frankish lords refused to permit the West Frankish king to inherit, and instead held four assemblies between 899 and 905, affirming their loyalty to the boy king, who was guided by the Archbishop of Mainz and other senior clergy. Similar collective action ensured a transition to Conrad I, leader of the Conradina family, as the first non-Carolingian king in 911, and again in 919 to recognize Henry I, head of the Ludolfinger, Ottonian, family. Immediate circumstances and force of personality played a part. Conrad I was assisted by the lack of any viable local alternative candidate. Nonetheless, the same group of dukes and other senior lords cooperated throughout, not through any sense of national consciousness, but because they recognized the East Frankish realm as a distinct political space, guaranteeing their own regional clientele networks that had developed across the previous century. A general sense of shared Frankish heritage persisted into the 970s at least, but East and West Francia were both now more clearly defined as separate kingdoms organized around their own royal families and assemblies. Later chroniclers exaggerated the level of consensus. Conrad I faced a 3-year revolt from the future Henry I, who demanded a greater share of the spoils, while the process of accepting Henry as king in 919 took 5 months and required considerable force during 920 to 921 to obtain acquiescence in Swabia and especially Bavaria, which retained considerable autonomy. Ottonian governance, 919 to 1024. The Ottonian remaking of the empire in some ways resembled the earlier Carolingian achievement in that it followed a series of victories over the heathens, notably Lechfeld in 955, continued in an invasion of Italy to rescue the Pope, and culminated in a carefully staged imperial coronation. The Ottonians were very conscious of Carolingian precedents and presented their rule as a revival of imperial authority rather than a new beginning. However, they emerged from within East Francia with a relatively restricted family power base in Saxony. Their rise to prominence was not accompanied by any significant redistribution of property, but rather rested on their acceptance of established lordly power and influence. Ottonian rule confirmed a super-elite of the original 4 dukes of Franconia, Swabia, Bavaria, and Saxony, plus those of Lorraine, Bohemia, and, more loosely, Burgundy, all of whom held quasi-viceregal powers over castles, royal monasteries, and associated resources. They assumed some of the perquisites of royalty, notably, by grace of God titles and seals for their own documents, less to challenge their king than to elevate themselves from the more numerous counts and lesser lords. The king remained far more than first among equals. Otto I did not visit Swabia for a decade after 939, but its duke came to see him 6 times. Although family possession of a ducal status was more clearly hereditary, the original core duchy of Franconia was almost invariably held by the king directly until Henry IV gave it to the Stauffers in 1079. The Ottonians also retained Saxony directly until 961, when it was passed to the Billungs. But the continued presence of extensive royal domains meant it was still known as the Emperor's Kitchen into the 11th century. Henry I's improved relations with Arnulf of Bavaria by 926 were an important factor in Otto I's election. Otto used the opportunity of Arnulf's death in 937 to assert firmer control over Bavaria before transferring it to his brother Heinrich in 948, who established the junior Ottonian branch that would provide Henry II as king after 1002. This arrangement was not unproblematic, because Heinrich's son and successor as duke, Heinrich II, the Quarrelsome, conspired with Poland and Bohemia and had to be deposed in 976 by Otto II, who also weakened Bavaria by detaching Carinthia and Austria. Heinrich II subsequently disputed Otto III's succession, but was pacified by restoration to Bavaria in 985. Although occasionally turbulent, the existence of distinct duchies nonetheless allowed the Ottonians to contain the ambitions of close family members without having to resort to full partition of the kingdom. Indeed, the royal family dominated ducal ranks. The 4 primary duchies were held more frequently by the king or a close male relative than by other families between about 900 and the 1080s. Lorraine was in a different category, given its association with the now defunct Carolingian Middle Kingdom of Lotharingia. Unlike the 4 German duchies, Lorraine was consistently ruled by indigenous dukes, though these were sometimes connected by marriage to the Ottonians. Although Swabia, Carinthia, and to an extent Bavaria, were held by other families, sons rarely followed fathers. The continued significance of ducal offices is further illustrated by the fact that the Ottonians and Salians never suppressed those duchies they held directly, nor incorporated their jurisdictions within the royal domains. In short, duchies remained the principal institution through which the king ruled the regions. The Ottonians successfully distanced themselves from the violence of the later Carolingian era. Conrad I had crushed the Swabian revolt in 915 by beheading the opposing nobles, and 2 years later he decapitated his brothers-in-law Erchanger and Berthold for rebellion. By contrast, the Ottonians were prepared to pardon opponents where this appeared both safe and expedient, as their treatment of Heinrich the Quarrelsome indicates. Meanwhile, their tacit acceptance of the counties as hereditary removed them from often messy local politics and allowed them to assume the status of superior, seemingly impartial judge. Conflicts followed generally recognized lines. The king was rarely attacked directly, since most disputes were over the pecking order within the ducal elite. Malcontents would protest by leaving the royal presence and use their own kinship and clientele networks to mobilize support against their rival. They might add pressure by devastating crops or plundering, generally targeting their rival's adherents, rather than risking a battle that would considerably raise the stakes. Participants in the dispute minimized risks by opposing particular royal decisions, not the king himself, in contrast to the late 9th century civil wars fought to control the throne. Military action was about demonstrating potency, while friends and other intermediaries discreetly sought a settlement. Negotiations were especially important where the malcontents opposed royal actions, since peace depended on finding a way they could submit without losing face. The Ottonians generally preferred magnanimity to harsh punishment, pardoning rebels and restoring at least most of their lands. The Ottonians drew additional strength from the imperial church. Otto I entrusted the governance of Mainz and Cologne to close relatives, but the family's growing confidence is illustrated by his grandson's ability to appoint bishops from a much wider social circle. Although plunder could still be won in campaigns against the Slavs and Magyars, the Ottonians also used royal prerogatives to create new rights that could be given as rewards to loyalty and service. Market, mint, and toll rights were granted to bishops, enabling them to exploit new economic opportunities. The conquest of Italy and imperial coronation dramatically improved Ottonian prestige and widened their political opportunities. Elevation to imperial status clearly placed Otto I far above the dukes, enabling him to relinquish Saxony, his original family homeland. However, Italy also expanded an already large realm, adding to the difficulties of governing through personal presence. Not all German lords were happy to see their king assume the ambitions and responsibilities associated with the imperial mission, especially as this required his presence south of the Alps. Otto I spent 10 of his last 12 years in Italy, finally returning in triumph to hold a succession of assemblies in 972 to 973 that conveyed a sense of solid support. However, many of the men he had known whilst German king were now dead, and it took his son Otto II until 980 to assert his own authority. Meanwhile, those Ottonian methods developed in Germany were not entirely transferable to the very different political landscape in Italy, where there were no large duchies other than Spoleto. Otto I relied heavily on Pandulf Ironhead, one of the last of the old Lombard elite, who was allowed to add Spoleto and Benevento to his original Duchy of Capua. Pandulf's death in 981 created a power vacuum in southern Italy, just as Otto II was blockading Venice to force it to renounce ties to Byzantium. Otto expanded his actions, elevating Salerno to an archbishopric to counter the Byzantine one in Otranto. He then marched south with perhaps the largest ever Ottonian army, including 4,000 armored cavalry, intending to demonstrate his imperial credentials by succeeding where the Byzantines had recently failed and drive the Saracens out of Calabria. He was lured into a trap and decisively defeated at Cotrone on the East Calabrian coast on the 13th of July 982. The Dukes of Bavaria and Swabia died, along with 16 counts and several bishops and abbots. Otto only escaped by riding out to sea, where he was rescued by a Greek ship, whose crew tried to kidnap him once they realized who he was. The disaster shook confidence in the Ottonians, who appeared to have lost divine favor. The heavy casualties amongst the elite intensified competition to fill the vacancies. Otto took the exceptional step of holding a joint Italian-German lordly assembly at Verona on Whitsun 983, rallying support and securing endorsement of his three-year-old son as co-king. Otto II's unexpected death in December 983 added to the crisis of the Slav revolt along the Elbe. Yet the situation demonstrated the inherent strengths of Ottonian rule. The years spent patiently cultivating the friendship of key lords now paid off, as most remained loyal, despite now serving a boy king, Otto III, under the female regency of his mother, Theophanu. Heinrich the Quarrelsome's support was restricted to the political and geographical periphery. The Dukes of Poland and Bohemia, the Abodrites, some Lorraine lords, and the Western Archbishops of Trier and Cologne. By acting as if he were already king, Heinrich alienated potential Saxon support. Careful negotiations gave him a face-saving way out and removed the need for Theophanu and her supporters to fight. Otto III's death in 1002 ended his family's main line and allowed Heinrich the Quarrelsome's son, Henry II, to seek recognition. He only gained acceptance after some violence in which a rival candidate, Margrave Eckehard of Meissen, was murdered and Strasbourg was plundered. Henry is usually presented as stepping back from the supposedly more expansive ambitions of his two immediate predecessors, but the change was mainly one of style, as he intensified the sacral element of kingship and toured the empire more extensively. Salian Command Monarchy, 1024 to 1137. Henry II's lack of children raised concern during his reign over the succession. The response was similar to that at the end of the Carolingian line. A meeting was organized at Camber on the Rhine, opposite Oppenheim, in the summer of 1024, by the inner circle comprising Henry's widow, Kunigunda, her brothers, the Duke of Bavaria, and Counts of Luxembourg and Mainz, and key bishops. The Salians were the only viable candidates. They were favored by Kunigunda and her relations, and were backed by the Lorraine aristocracy, perhaps because of their shared roots in the Rhineland. There was currently no Duke of Franconia, since this post had been retained directly by the king since 939, while Swabia was held by a minor at that point. The Saxons, Italians, and Slavs appear to have stayed away. Consequently, the proceedings became a discreet test of how much support the two Salian branches could muster. Conrad, the second, the elder, heading the junior Salian branch based at Speyer, emerged as the favorite, allegedly because he already had a son. Conrad the younger, of the senior, older, Worms branch, left Camber with his supporters before the result was announced publicly, thereby preserving the appearance of unanimity. The Saxons continue to maintain their distance as in 1002, requiring Conrad II to secure their acceptance separately at Minden in December. Conrad encountered difficulties broadly similar to Henry I a century previously, but on a far wider scale because he succeeded to Italy as well as Germany, and inherited Henry II's claims to Burgundy. Opposition in Swabia only ended when its duke, Ernst, was killed in 1030, and it took a further 2 years for Conrad to secure both Italy and Burgundy. Conrad's success confirmed the empire as a hierarchy of three principal kingdoms, headed by Germany, Italy, and Burgundy. The challenge of governance was now even greater than under the Ottonians. The expanded size of the realm added to the difficulties of governing through personal presence. Meanwhile, the lordly hierarchy had lengthened and its members had become more numerous. There were now several pushy new families who had the power, though not yet the status of dukes, achieved by acquiring several counties and placing relations in the imperial church. In addition to the Salians themselves, these included the Echechadina at Meissen, the Luxembourgs, Etzenids, Babenbergs, and Welfs. There were also more numerous and distinct lesser nobles, plus the class of servile ministeriales emerging around 1020. These were not, as once thought, a royal creation to free the king from dependency on the great lords, but instead, ministeriales were promoted by the imperial clergy. Bishops and abbots selected able men of unfree status and enfeoffed them with resources to enable them to serve as knights or administrators. The Salians also began employing ministeriales to administer royal domains and garrison the new castles built in the 1060s. The ministeriales gradually acquired other privileges, embraced an aristocratic ethos, and eventually converted their relationship based on servitude into one of more conventional vassalage to fuse with other lesser nobles as knights and barons by about 1300. It would be wrong to interpret the ministeriales as the potential staff required to create a centralized monarchy. They were indeed used to oversee more intensive management of royal domains, notably in Saxony. However, the Salians were themselves a product of the same political culture as their lords. There was no blueprint for a centralized state to follow, nor evidence that anyone thought such a structure was superior. Instead, Conrad and his successors tried to improve established methods by making it harder for lords to refuse royal commands. Conrad's well-known articulation of the empire as an enduring crown was one element in this, as was the increasing emphasis on royal authority, underpinned by a more elevated, sacral monarchical image. Conrad remained in the late Ottonian mold of an emperor touring the empire to meet lordly expectations of good kingship. One-fifth of his trips were to Saxony, where the local lords clearly resented the Salian accession and their displacement to the outer circle. This paid off, and Henry III's accession in 1039 resembled a triumphal progress. Conrad also returned to the earlier policy of concentrating duchies in royal hands as they became vacant. Bavaria in 1027, Swabia in 1038, and Carinthia in 1039. All three passed along with Franconia to Henry III on his accession, but he broke past practice by giving them away, keeping only Bavaria. Bavaria was held by a king or his son for 46 years between 1002 and 1125, with the other six individuals chosen from close allies, though four had to be deposed after brief periods by the king. Meanwhile, the Salians continued Henry II's practice of promoting Bamberg, Eichstätt, and other Bavarian bishops as counterweights. This seems to have worked well, and Henry IV had little difficulty retaining their loyalty after 1075, unlike Saxony, where the policy of backing the Archbishop of Bremen simply antagonized local lords further and contributed to the Saxon revolt in 1073. This policy represented a fundamental shift from using ducal jurisdictions directly to a more indirect management of the ducal elite. It reduced friction by accepting the trend to hereditary possession, which was already clearly established in Lorraine, and soon also Swabia. The king retained powers of confirmation, But local elections were now far more like homage ceremonies, where the new duke sought acceptance from the lesser lords. Ducal power rested on possession of significant allodial property, much of it often former royal domains, as well as clearer political jurisdiction over the lesser nobles. However, the ducal elite faced harsher punishments if they abused their new autonomy. The Ottonians had operated what was essentially a two-strikes policy, with only repeat offenders facing serious consequences, though even here exceptions were made, as in the case of Heinrich the Quarrelsome. This was no longer possible under the more elevated concept of monarchy cultivated by the Salians. Rebellion ceased to be a personal dispute over status and became an affront to divine order. It was harder to forgive wrongdoers who were now considered sinners. Using the Roman law concept of crimen lysae maiestatis, revived by Henry III, Salians no longer simply removed offenders from office, but also confiscated their allodial property. The difficulties of the new course were already exposed in 1035, when Conrad II deposed Adalbero Eppensteiner as Duke of Carinthia for pursuing a policy towards the Hungarians contrary to royal wishes. Conrad clearly intended an assembly of lords as a pliant court to endorse his verdict. But many of those present expressed disquiet, including the king's son, Henry III, who, as Duke of Bavaria, had sworn friendship with Adalbero. Conrad secured consent by falling to the floor crying, a move that could easily have backfired and damaged his prestige. Although Henry III appears to have curried favor by reversing many of his father's decisions, he continued the same methods, encountering even greater difficulties when he tried to enforce a new partition in Lorraine after 1044. He eventually achieved his goal, but alienated the duke's relations in Tuscany. Long the beneficiary of Ottonian patronage, the Tuscans had proved crucial in Conrad II's victory over Italian opposition to his succession from 1024 to 1027. Tuscany's defection to Pope Gregory VII after 1077 was a serious blow to the imperial position in Italy. The absence of other large jurisdictions necessitated a different approach to governing south of the Alps. The Salians spent only 22 of their 101 years of rule in Italy, and half of that was Henry IV's largely unwilling presence during the investiture wars. Their preferred method was to rely on the Italian bishops, both by appointing loyalists trained in the royal chapel and by strengthening the episcopate by extending their control over their cathedral towns and surrounding area. This made some sense, given that demographic and economic growth began earlier in Italy than in Germany, eroding the old county structure and fueling popular demands for greater civic autonomy. The Salians were not necessarily hostile to these developments, for instance, extending their patronage by giving the post of royal judge to wealthy townsmen, some of whom subsequently rose to become counts or bishops. Conrad II also intervened to settle what became known as the Valvasores Revolt between 1035 and 1037. The Valvasores were the sub-vassals of the captains, capitanei, who held both urban property and church fiefs in the surrounding countryside. Conrad's Constitutio de Feudis of the 28th of May 1037 extended the benefits of hereditary possession of fiefs to the lesser lords, whilst continuing to assert the king as final judge of all disputes. These policies were unintentionally conflictual, because they weakened episcopal authority over the Valvasores and captains, notably in Milan, where a complex dispute developed over popular demands for autonomy and conflicting claims from the emperor and pope to intervene. When aligned with the difficulties encountered over Lorraine, this suggests the Salians were already encountering serious structural problems ahead of Henry IV's minority following his father's death in 1056. The Saxon and Investiture Wars, 1073 to 1122. Discontent amongst East Saxon lords coincided with the first stages of what would become the investiture dispute around 1073. Neither of these problems was immediately life-threatening for the Salian monarchy. Henry IV continued to enjoy considerable support amongst the German and Italian episcopates, as well as many lay lords. However, his inability to find quick solutions to these problems fueled underlying discontent at Salian methods and gave credence to charges of misrule. A more exalted style of monarchy inhibited the cultivation of friends and made it difficult to compromise without losing face, and Henry rebuffed several attempts by lay and secular lords to broker settlements. Royal prestige was now defined by power and victory, not consensus and clemency. Unfortunately, open defiance, as in Saxony, left the king no choice but to employ force. The Salians were thus in the same bind in Germany as the Ottonians had been in earlier disputes with the papacy. Violent methods conflicted with most people's ideal of good kingship. The German lords provided Henry with an opportunity to restore politics to the earlier consensual course by summoning him to their assembly at Tribor in October 1076. Yet acceptance would have entailed an unacceptable humiliation, and so Henry undertook his extraordinary journey to Canossa in an attempt to outflank his opponents by reaching a deal with Pope Gregory. The move failed to stop the malcontents electing Rudolf of Rheinfelden as the first real anti-king in March 1077. Rudolf was backed by the leading Saxons, the Dukes of Bavaria and Carinthia, and around eight middling secular lords, plus the archbishops of Mainz, Salzburg, Magdeburg, and their suffragan bishops. The majority of lay and ecclesiastical lords were still loyal to the emperor, or at least neutral. However, the combination of civil war in Germany and the open struggle with the Gregorian papacy intensified the divisions. Both Henry and the Gregorians deposed each other's supporters from the episcopate, while the king replaced the rebellious southern dukes with loyalists in 1079, including the Staufers, who received Swabia. There were now rival kings, popes, dukes, and bishops, entrenching the conflict in the localities and widening the numbers of those involved with vested interests. The relatively even balance prevented either side from achieving sufficient preponderance to force their opponents to accept peace. Although obstinate, Henry was sufficiently astute to seize the collapse of the Welf-Tuscan alliance in 1095, not merely to escape from northern Italy, but to offer significant concessions across the next 3 years. This confirmed one of the two main political outcomes of this turbulent period: the demise of the old ducal elite and its replacement by a more numerous group controlling more modest jurisdictions. This group was recruited from the middling families, who had amassed allodial property and county jurisdictions, and were now accommodated by the creation of new jurisdictions associated with ducal rank. Henry reconciled the Zeringer, whom he had deposed from Carinthia in 1078, by raising their allodial property in the Black Forest to a new duchy 20 years later. This was rounded out by transferring Zurich, the richest royal domain in the region, as well as other jurisdictions formerly associated with Swabia. Meanwhile, the Counts Palatine emerged as equivalent to dukes on the Middle Rhine by 1156. Henry V continued this policy after his accession in 1106, which coincided with the extinction of the Saxon Billungs. Although Saxony was not partitioned, Henry gave the Billung allodial property to the rising Ascania and Welf families. Other jurisdictions in Saxony were consolidated as a distinct landgraviate of Thuringia by 1131, while the remnants of what had been the Saxon North March, Nordmark, were detached in 1134, becoming the Margraviate of Brandenburg after 1157. The tentative return to consensual politics unraveled as Henry V sought to supplant his father after 1105, leading to renewed war until the latter's death the following year. Henry V's heavy handling of his former favorite, Lothar von Supplinburg, triggered another revolt in 1112 to 1115, during which the king lost control of northern Germany and only survived thanks to continued Staufer support. Antagonism resurfaced at Henry V's death in 1125. The leading Guelf, Heinrich the Black of Bavaria, defected from his former Staufer allies and backed the election of Lothar von Supplinburg. Konrad Staufer of Franconia was proclaimed king by his own supporters, including his elder brother in Swabia, splitting Germany north-south. He only accepted defeat in 1135 in return for a pardon, finally allowing Lothar III to tour the south. The outcome confirmed the second lasting consequence from the Troubles since 1073. Command monarchy was discredited and defeated. The Tribor meeting of 1076 was the first of what historians have called kingless assemblies, Königlose Tage, as senior lords convened on their own initiative. Other meetings followed in 1105, 1121, and 1122. The latter compelling Henry V to settle the investiture dispute with the Worms Concordat. Although further collective action failed to avert violence in 1125, Lothar III nonetheless returned to a more consensual style. However, this did not restore Ottonian conditions. Instead, the restructured elite now saw themselves as sharing responsibility for the empire's welfare. This was expressed as emperor and empire, imperator et regnum, first voiced at the 1122 assembly and signifying that lords expected to participate in important decisions rather than merely offer advice. It remained for the Staufers to adapt governance to meet these expectations.